Thank you, Julia. That was wonderful. Very thought-provoking and uplifting at the same time, which is not always an easy combination. I thought it was interesting. You refer to the document that you've prepared in 2003, the responsibilities document, that your group is doing that. And of course, as I mentioned, the Interaction Council have prepared what they call a Universal Declaration of Human Responsibilities. And we also mentioned the environmental side of things. The Earth Charter could be regarded again as a kind of expression or declaration of responsibilities. And all these different groups around the world are thinking about this whole issue of responsibilities. And I think it's wonderful that it's coming to the fore. Another interesting thing I thought you said about the right to education, in Uganda, this sort of that's an expression, isn't it, of the principle of subsidiarity, as people like to say, where the responsibility gets taken down as far as it can be, which is another issue that perhaps governments are not particularly good at. They like to keep the power all to themselves, don't they? So, in a sense, perhaps that's another one of our responsibilities as citizens, is to think about ways in which power could come down in our direction and we could use it. So, perhaps now we could have a little bit of a question and answer session for Julia, if anyone has any, well, questions, answers, reflections, responses, you name it. What we'll do is we'll have a roving mic, and if you could wait until the roving mic actually reaches you, because it's not because we probably can't hear you, it's more because we're actually recording what's going on. We're going to make a transcript. So please wait until the microphone reaches you. And if you want to say something, please put up your hand and keep it up so we can see that you want to say something. And I can see already we have a gentleman bidding to say the first thing. Keep that hand up, sir. Please keep that hand up. Right. Here we are.
Thank you very much. I think it was Plato who said that democracy was one step ahead of anarchy in his six grades or levels of government, general government. That's not really the point that I wanted to raise, but it is one worth holding in mind, I think, because if rights and responsibilities are not held in a reasonable equilibrium, the very first thing you do get is anarchy. And it's largely as a result, I think, of people taking advantage of the idea of rights and responsibilities out of context. But the point that I'd like to raise, really, is that of the law of karma. We're talking in terms of spirituality. Now, the way in which the law of karma actually works is to apply discipline according to circumstances. And from that particular point of view, one might suggest that those who do not have a great deal of material position, of experience, in fact, who have less of everything, are less liable to the same sort of karma. But justice in these circumstances would suggest that those who have more and who have more experience should have the greatest degree of discipline imposed upon them as a result of infringing responsibility and duty. So that itself would require a change of government. Not a change of government, but a change of the governing ethos towards equity. And a lot of thought actually going with it, too.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very challenging point. Human rights, in some ways, doesn't really help us there, because human rights being universal doesn't really make a distinction between people on any basis. However, I think certainly within my understanding of responsibilities in the broader sense of the word, that is almost implied. And I've certainly noticed in the reading that I was doing in preparation of this talk this afternoon that a lot of authors are talking about the additional responsibilities of the advanced democracies that we are educated. Therefore, we really do have a greater responsibility than in bygone years when we might not have had the opportunity to find out, to know, or to act on, or the empowerment to act on our concerns and beliefs. So I think in a sort of general, broad brush way, many people would recognize that. They might not talk about it as being the law of karma, but certainly, say, in the law in Britain, as you get older as a child, your level of responsibility increases. It's at 18 you're allowed to vote, but under 18 you still have responsibilities as a citizen, as a human being. But the level of those responsibilities obviously changes with your growing understanding and education. So I think it's a very good point. I think it would be incredibly difficult to formulate in a precise term what the difference would be. But I think in terms of the principle, I think it's a very good point.
What, something that occurs to me is reminds me of Christ's parable of the talents, of those who have much is expected. Mm. And the interesting thing is, when you think about it, that's almost a little bit the argument which the developing world uses with respect to things like Kyoto, the Kyoto Protocol. They sort of say, well, we don't have so much, so you shouldn't expect us to do so much. You have the money. You have the technology. You should be expected to do more, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and so on. So I think it's an interesting fact that that argument gets reflected in the real world in international negotiations almost. Whether it's actually the right application of the argument is a little bit dubious. Mm. You know, it's a little bit dubious, but. Mm. At the same time, it's one argument that can be used. Now, I think there was a gentleman here.
I wonder if you could just expand a little bit on your point about ethnicity and policing done based on ethnicity and on another point. But could you just expand a little? I'm just a bit confused as to how that actually applies to how it goes against human rights, as you see it.
Thank you. I should perhaps preface my remarks on this by saying that I was overwhelmed by my ignorance when I started reading some of this material, so I'm not speaking from a very strong knowledge base. But the article that I was reading, it was actually a book, which is looking at the war of terror and citizenship and the link between them. It was making the argument that the security issue has been so prominent in Britain since 9/11 and the July bombings in London that there has been a tendency within policing to be very concerned about the terrorist threat, which is then, as we all know, being put at the feet of Islamic members of our population, and particularly people who look as if they might have come from the Middle East and beyond. So that the argument was saying that there was almost like a presumption of, you know, of suspects based on the ethnicity and the religion, rather than on the normal criteria of collecting evidence. Now, as I say, this is not my point, and I don't know sufficient about the facts. But certainly, as a reader of newspapers and somebody who, you know, talks to an awful lot of Muslims in Britain, it certainly would appear to be the case that people do feel that they're being disproportionately challenged. It reminds me very much of the problems that the police had in terms of black young black men, you know, a decade ago, where a young black man was far more likely to be stopped on the street than a white woman, for instance. So it was that really was the concern.
If I may, I'd like to take that point a step further about people feeling disproportionately discriminated against. The government is currently shoehorning an ID scheme in, which I don't know if you know about, but effectively they've chosen a soft target of foreign students outside the European Economic Area. And this is something that's of immediate concern, and I wondered if you had any thoughts or opinions on that.
I haven't been following the debates. I mean, I have to, as you probably gathered, our work is international. We're not specifically focusing on the UK. So I haven't been following that. I know that there are many concerns about the ID card from civil liberties and human rights people in Britain across the board. So to start with any one community, particularly when it's an overseas community, it would ring a bell of alarm in my head.
I think it goes back to what you were saying about the human rights are the rights of human beings, not citizens. So it seems a little bit
exactly.
Ridiculous. But just right behind you, Joan.
I would just like to highlight the Article 1 of the human rights in relation to the class-conscious culture.
All rights are born. All humans are born equal in rights and dignity. Is this what you're referring
yes.
to? You've said it all.
The thing is, we're born equal. That's the the issue, isn't it? Really.
I think the. I remember Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, saying at one of our conferences that he thought that one of the greatest gifts that the Judeo-Christian religions had brought was the fact that the focus on humans as being in the image of God. I think you could say that Islam also has the same belief. So that if every human being is in the image of God, they must be born equal. And so anything that refutes that equality or hampers the ability of human beings to live in accordance with their equality and their equal dignity is likely to be a violation of human rights. The question then becomes, and this is where I almost took issue with you, Dominic, when you said that... I was kissing out my arm to bash your nose.
Okay.
But when you said that there are cultures that don't necessarily agree with human rights in the same way.
Hmm.
And I thought about that, and I thought, well, I would like to say, because the work that we've done is that every culture, people from everywhere in the world understand the fundamental concept of human rights.
Hmm.
And we've never met any people that deny it. However, then you look at societies, whether you're looking at tribal societies or the caste system in India or the class system in Britain or whatever, and you find that some ways that society operates is not necessarily in accordance with the fundamental principles. And this is why people are working so hard to rectify it.
I think the issue you've opened up there is a whole other conference on the economic system and the social system that we have. So perhaps next year we could have that discussion. But it's a very good point that you made.
Okay.
I think three more people, in fact. So first of all, I think you had your hand up first, then you, and then so that's three people now. Okay, Joan, so if you could come first of all to this lady here.
I just wanted to make one very small point on the rather worrying elision between ethnicity and anybody who might look Middle Eastern and Islam.
Yeah.
A cousin of mine, the gentlest soul on this planet, who happens to be half Irish, half Indian, born of two Christian parents, now a Buddhist, is constantly being stopped since 9/11, and of course he carries a musical case over his shoulder. So, you know, that's a serious problem for somebody living in North London on a daily basis, knowing that he's suspect.
Horrible, isn't it?
Horrible, really horrible. On the second point I wanted to make, and I apologise for arriving late because of a traffic jam, is the worry that security, the flip side of that is, of course, fear, which I'm sure probably Dominic mentioned. But actually it's about fear, which, of course, from Alice Bailey we know the fear and the greed are going to do the sort of regular figure of eight during this period of history. And I thought, actually, the fear is never mentioned. We talk about security, and I think that's a major deception.
Well, as I was discussing this whole topic with my colleague James, and he was pointing out that actually the whole response in Britain to this is based on fear. And the whole debate about what is Britishness. I mean, excuse me? Why do we need this debate? And I think that whole retreat from multiculturalism, which we were beginning to get almost right, and into this attempt to have an assimilation policy, which has gone so badly wrong in France and other countries, has to be something to do with fear, because there's no rational explanation otherwise. I think you're right. Yes.
It's a fear of that kind of dilution of identity, isn't it? Mm. That somehow Britishness is somehow dissolving because other cultures are coming in. Oh. You had a point, is that right? Yeah.
You did touch on the rights of the duties towards the environment, which just about embraces everything else we've talked about. It also means our responsibilities towards future generations. And we talk a lot about it, but we don't seem to be doing nearly enough, fast enough. And I'm wondering whether that there is talk in many different countries about an actual bill of environmental rights. I believe one country has already drawn this up in Latin America. Do you think that this is practicable? If there is a bill of environmental rights, would it be enforceable? And would it help with to spur on our fulfilment of duties towards our environmental obligations?
Thank you, Diana. Well, in Ecuador, it's Ecuador I think you're referring to, they've actually, in their new constitution, included the right of nature to be respected and protected. Of course, I applaud any attempt to strengthen our protection of the environment. I have to say, though, that as an international human rights lawyer, and speaking as a lawyer rather than an environmental activist, I would hesitate to go down the route of trying to draw up a document about nature's rights. Because I think what's much more important is to draw up a document about our responsibilities to protect it. And drawing up these legal documents takes an incredible long time, and it uses up a lot of resources. We'd all have to be flying around the world to meet and to do it, which would be creating more problems, etc., etc. So I've got some sort of strategic and practical objections to it. And then who would enforce it and how? I think the principle of it is very important, and I think the principle of recognising that all of nature it should be protected is very important. And I particularly liked your reference to the rights of future generations. Some of us who are involved in pushing forward the interpretation of existing international law are already trying to interpret it to require that. So we're saying, yes, but the right to health is the right of everyone, including future generations, and therefore the water cannot be toxic from poisoned by minerals. So you can interpret quite a lot of existing law in that way and hopefully achieve a quicker, more speedy and sustainable result.
In fact, what you've just said, I was thinking of mentioning that in my talk, that perhaps that one of the human responsibilities is indeed to extend interpretation of human rights in different ways towards precisely the environment as an area, which is an obvious one. I think there was a gentleman directly behind you again, Joan, that's right in the yellow. And I think after you, sir, we'll have time for one more comment, and then we'll be doing some work ourselves. So...
I'm not sure it's a question. Julia, right at, towards the end, talked about congruence, and this made me think, is she thinking of at the micro level, the individual level, or the macro level, the international or country level of congruence? And congruence, I think, is a very important concept here. I wanted her to expand on it, if she could possibly. It immediately took me to the ideas of perhaps one of the greatest 20th century men, Carl Rogers, in his Rogerian counselling stipulations, if you like, where congruence is an essential part of a, say, a therapist's demeanour or being, if you like. And then, of course, the empathy that he required. I mean, what sort of empathy we have for people around the world, getting the information in, trying to think how it is to be in their shoes, as it were. And, of course, the overriding spiritual thing, which, of course, is unconditional love, which Rogers called unconditional positive regard, of course. So could you please expand on congruence in this subject?
Thank you very much. I mean it at all of those levels. I certainly mean it at the individual level. And I think that the greatest work that any of us can do is to work on ourselves and to make sure that we really are living our lives according to our beliefs. In fact, that was the basis of our principles of responsibility. One of our supporters, Lord Stone, said, I've read all your literature, I agree with everything you said, but not everybody has time to do that. Can you collapse it down into a few simple principles that I can put up by my shaving mirror and I can look at myself every day and say, am I leading my life according to these principles? Well, we did write it, but I haven't written it back to front yet, so I haven't got it for the mirror. I meant it at that level. I also mean it at a community level, a society level, at the international level. And one of the strengths of human rights and responsibilities, I believe, is that every government in the world has signed up to human rights law at some extent. Every government, and the Children's Convention is the most ratified convention. So every government has subscribed to human rights law. All people of faith and cultures, agree that there is some sort of level of values and responsibilities. And therefore, we've got this legal framework and moral compass in rights and responsibilities that could actually shape the global response for concerted action. So if we, as a global society, are congruent to those fundamental beliefs that we've signed up to or fundamentally believe in, then we can start tackling the world's crises. And I think the example of the current financial crisis is the same, that if we stop tinkering around with the concept of banks and financial institutions, which probably, if the rest of you are like me, sort of leaves us a little bit confused as to what is actually going on, and I understand even the experts are not really sure what is actually going on, if we can leave that aside for a moment and just go back to a fundamental issue of we are part of a global community. We need an economy. We need to have structures in place that regulate institutions of that economy. How should they be formulated? What guiding principles can we bring to bear on this situation? So I'm going to be an optimist and say that I believe that the financial crisis is a real opportunity for all of us to be congruent to our beliefs and stand up and say that the restructuring of the financial institutions and the global economy must be guided by these fundamental principles so that they are just equitable and sustainable and deliver for everybody. So I think congruence is at every level. But thank you for the question.
Amen. I don't think we have any more time, actually, because that was quite a long discussion there. Thank you again, Julia, for an absolutely wonderful presentation.